But on one condition. Harry waited. When the book is published, you'll do an author tour, because the public will be fascinated to know how you managed to smuggle the manuscript out of the Soviet Union. Harry nodded, and the two men stood up and shook hands. Something else Aaron had in common with his father. A handshake was quite enough to show that the deal had been closed. In a Ginsberg contract, there were no get-out clauses. And while you're over here, I need to finalize a new 3-book contract for the William Warwick series. On the same terms as Babakov, said Harry. Why, will he be writing those as well? Both men laughed before shaking hands a second time. Who's publishing Uncle Joe in England? Asked Aaron as he sat back down. Billy Collins. We closed the deal last week. Same terms? Wouldn't you like to know? Mind you, when I get home, he's certain to ask me the same question. And he'll get the same reply, no doubt. Now, Harry, your timing couldn't be better, because I need to speak to you on another subject in the strictest confidence. Harry leaned back in his chair. I've always wanted Viking to merge with an appropriate paperback house, so I don't have to make separate deals the whole time. Several other companies have already gone down that road, as I'm sure you know. But if I remember correctly, your father was always against the idea. He feared it would stifle his independence. And he still feels that way. But he's no longer chairman, and I've decided it's time to move up a gear. I've recently been offered an attractive deal by Rex Mulberry of Mulberry House. The old order changeth, yielding place to new. Remind me. Tennyson, Mort d'Arthur. So, are you prepared to yield to new? Although I don't know Rex Mulberry, I'll happily back your judgment, said Harry. Good. Then I'll have both contracts drawn up immediately. If you can get Mrs. Babakova to sign hers, I'll have yours ready by the time you get back from Pittsburgh. She'll probably resist taking an advance payment, or even royalties, so I'll just have to remind her that the last thing Anatoly said before they dragged him off was, make sure Yelena doesn't have to spend the rest of her life in a different kind of prison. That should do the trick. Possibly, but I know she still considers it nothing less than her duty to suffer the same deprivation her husband is experiencing. Then you must explain to her that we can't publish the book if she doesn't sign the contract. She will sign the contract, but only because she wants the whole world to know the truth about Joseph Stalin. I'm not convinced she'll ever cash the check. Try deploying that irresistible Clifton charm. Aaron rose from behind his desk. Lunch? The Yale Club? Certainly not. Pa still eats there every day, and I don't want him to find out what I'm up to. Harry rarely read the business section of any newspaper, but today he made an exception. The New York Times had devoted half a page to the merger between the Viking Press and Mulberry House, alongside a photograph of Aaron shaking hands with Rex Mulberry. Viking would have 34% of the new company, while Mulberry, a far bigger house, would control 66%. When the Times asked Aaron how his father felt about the deal, he simply replied, Curtis Mulberry and my father have been close friends for many years. I am delighted to have formed a partnership with his son, and look forward to an equally long and fruitful relationship. Hear, hear to that, said Harry, as a dining car waiter poured him a second cup of coffee. He glanced out of the window to see the skyscrapers of Manhattan becoming smaller and smaller as the train continued on its journey to Pittsburgh. Harry sat back, closed his eyes, and thought about his meeting with Yelena Babakova. He just hoped she would fall in with her husband's wishes. He tried to recall Anatoly's exact words. Aaron Ginsberg had risen early, excited by the prospect of his first day as deputy chairman of the new company. Viking Mulberry, he murmured into the shaving mirror. He liked the billing. His first meeting that day was scheduled for 12 o'clock, when Harry would report back on his visit with Mrs. Babakova. He planned to publish Uncle Joe in April, and was delighted that Harry had agreed to go on tour. After a light breakfast, toast and Oxford marmalade, a 3.5-minute boiled egg and a cup of Earl Grey tea, Aaron read the article in the New York Times for a second time. He felt it was a fair reflection of his agreement with Rex Mulberry, and was pleased to see his new partner repeating something he'd said to Aaron many times. "I am proud of you joining a house with such a fine literary tradition." As it was a clear, crisp morning, Aaron decided to walk to work and savour the thought of starting life anew. He wondered how long it would be before his father admitted he'd made the right decision if the company were to play in the major leagues. He crossed the road onto 7th Avenue, his smile broadening with each step he took. As he walked towards the familiar building, he noticed two smartly dressed doormen standing at the entrance, not an expense his father would have approved of. One of the men stepped forward and saluted.
"Good morning, Mr. Ginsburg."
Aaron was impressed that they knew his name.
"We have been instructed, sir, not to allow you to enter the building."
Aaron was struck dumb.
"There must be some mistake," he eventually managed. "I'm deputy chairman of the company."
"I'm sorry, sir, but those are our instructions," said the second guard, stepping forward to block his path.
"There must be some mistake," repeated Aaron.
"There is no mistake, sir. Our instructions were clear. If you attempt to enter the building, we are to prevent you from doing so."
Aaron hesitated for a moment before taking a pace back. He stared up at the newly minted sign declaring Viking Mulberry, then attempted to enter the building once again, but neither guard budged an inch. Reluctantly, he turned away and hailed a cab, giving the driver his home address. There must be a simple explanation, he kept telling himself, as the taxi headed towards 67th Street. Once he was back in his apartment, Aaron picked up the phone and dialed a number he didn't need to look up.
"Good morning, Viking Mulberry. How can I help you?"
"Rex Mulberry."
"Who's calling, please?"
"Aaron Ginsburg."
He heard a click, and a moment later another voice said,
"Chairman's office."
"This is Aaron Ginsburg. Put me through to Rex."
"Mr. Mulberry is in a meeting."
"Then get him out of the meeting," said Aaron, finally losing his temper.
Another click. He'd been cut off. He dialed the number again, but this time he didn't get any further than the switchboard. Collapsing into the nearest chair, he tried to gather his thoughts. It was some time before he picked up the phone again.
"Friedman, Friedman and Yablon," announced a voice.
"This is Aaron Ginsburg. I need to speak to Leonard Friedman."
He was immediately put through to the senior partner. Aaron took his time explaining what had happened when he turned up at his office that morning, and the result of his two subsequent phone calls.
"So your father was right all along."
"What do you mean?"
"A handshake was always good enough for Curtis Mulberry, but when you deal with his son Rex, just make sure you read the small print."
"Are you suggesting Mulberry's got right on his side?"
"Certainly not," said Friedman. "Just the law. As long as he controls 66% of the company's stock, he can call the shots. We did warn you at the time of the consequences of being a minority shareholder, but you were convinced it wouldn't be a problem. Although, I have to admit, even I'm shocked by the speed with which Mulberry has taken advantage of his position."
Once Friedman had taken his client through the relevant details of the contract, Aaron wished he'd read law at Harvard and not history at Yale.
"Still," said the lawyer, "we did manage to insert Clause 19A, which Mulberry will surely now live to regret."
"Why is Clause 19A so important?"
After Friedman had explained the significance of the get-out clause in great detail, Aaron put the phone down and walked across to the drinks cabinet. He poured himself a whiskey. Before 12 o'clock, for the first time in his life. 12 o'clock,
the time of his appointment with Harry. He glanced at his watch. 11:38. He put down his drink and ran out of the apartment. He cursed the slow lift as it trundled down to the ground floor, where he hurled back the grill and ran out onto the street. He hailed a yellow cab, never a problem on Fifth Avenue, but once he hit Third, Aaron was faced with the inevitable gridlock. Light after light seemed to turn red just as the cab reached the front of the line. When they ground to a halt at the next set of lights, Aaron handed the driver a $5 bill and leapt out. He ran the last two blocks, dodging in and out of the traffic, horns blaring, as he tried to stay on the move. The two guards were still stationed outside the building, almost as if they were expecting him to return. Aaron checked his watch on the run, 4 minutes to 12. He prayed that Harry would be late. Harry was never late. Then he saw him about 100 yards away, striding in his direction. But he arrived at the front of the building just moments before Aaron. The guard stood aside and allowed him to pass. Someone else they were expecting.
"Harry! Harry!"
shouted Aaron, now only a few strides from the front door. But Harry had already entered the building.
"Harry!"
Aaron screamed again as he reached the entrance. But the two guards marched forward and blocked his path, just as Harry stepped into a lift. When the lift door opened, Harry was surprised not to find Kirsty waiting for him. Funny how you get used to something, he thought, even take it for granted. He made his way across to the reception desk and told an unfamiliar young woman his name.
"I have an appointment with Aaron Ginsberg."
She checked her day sheet.
"Yes, you're down to see the chairman at 12, Mr. Clifton. You'll find him in Mr. Ginsberg's old office."
"His old office?"
said Harry, unable to mask his surprise.
"Yes, the room at the far end of the corridor."
"I know where it is,"
Harry replied, before heading off towards Aaron's office. He knocked on the door and waited.
"Come in,"
said a voice he didn't recognize. Harry opened the door and immediately assumed he walked into the wrong room. The walls had been stripped of their magnificent oak paneling, and the distinguished author's photographs replaced by a set of gaudy prints of Soho. A man he'd never met before, but whom he recognized from his photograph in that morning's New York Times, rose from behind a trestle table and thrust out a hand.
"Rex Mulberry. Delighted to meet you at last, Harry."
"Good morning, Mr. Mulberry," said Harry. "I have an appointment with my publisher, Aaron Ginsberg."
"I'm afraid Aaron doesn't work here any longer," said Mulberry. "I'm the chairman of the new company, and the board decided that the time had come for Viking to make some radical changes. But let me assure you, I'm a great admirer of your work."
"So you're a fan of Wilfred Warwick, are you?"
said Harry.
"Yes, I'm a huge fan of Wilfred's. Have a seat."
Harry reluctantly sat down opposite the new chairman.
"I've just been over your latest contract, which I'm sure you'll agree is generous by normal publishing standards."
"I have only ever been published by Viking, so I've nothing to compare it with."
"And of course we will honor Aaron's most recent contract in the Wilfred Warwick series, as well as the one for Uncle Joe."
Harry tried to think what Sebastian would have done in these circumstances. He was aware that the contract for Uncle Joe was in his inside pocket, and after some considerable persuasion, had been signed by Yelena Babakova.
"Aaron had agreed to prepare a new 3-book contract, which I had intended to go over with him today," he said,
playing for time.
"Yes, I have it here," said Mulberry. "There are a few minor adjustments, none of them of any real significance," he added, as he pushed the contract across the table.
Harry turned to the last page, to find Rex Mulberry's signature already on the dotted line. He took out his fountain pen, a gift from Aaron, removed the top, and stared down at the words, "On behalf of the author." He hesitated before saying the first thing that came into his head.
I need to go to the lavatory. I came straight from Grand Central, as I didn't want to be late.
Mulberry forced a smile as Harry placed the elegant parka on the table beside the contract.
I won't be long,
Harry added as he rose from his seat and casually left the room. Harry closed the door behind him, walked quickly down the corridor, past the reception desk, and didn't stop until he reached the lobby, where he stepped inside the first available lift. When the doors opened again on the ground floor, he joined the bustle of office workers who were making their way out of the building for their lunch break. He glanced at the two guards, but they didn't give him a second look as he passed them. They seemed to be focused on someone standing sentinel-like on the opposite side of the street. Harry turned his back on Aaron and hailed a cab.
Where to?
I'm not sure yet, said Harry. But could you drive across to the far corner and pick up the gentleman who's standing there?
The cabbie came to a halt on the other side of the street. Harry wound down the window.
Jump in,
he shouted. Aaron looked suspiciously inside, but when he saw Harry, he quickly joined him in the back.
Did you sign the contract?
Were his first words.
No, I did not.
What about the Babakov contract?
I still have it, said Harry, touching the inside pocket of his jacket. Then we just may be in the clear.
Not yet. I persuaded Mrs. Babakova that she should cash Viking's check for $100,000.
Help, said Aaron.
Where to?
Demanded the cabbie again.
Grand Central Station, said Harry.
Can't you just phone her?
Said Aaron.
She doesn't have a phone.
Chapter 6
It's the first time I've ever known you do something dishonest,
said Emma, as she poured herself a second cup of coffee.
But surely it's morally defensible, said Harry. After all, the end justified the means. Even that's questionable. Don't forget that Mrs. Babakova had already signed the contract and accepted the check in payment. But she hadn't cashed it, and in any case, she was under the impression Anatoly's book would be published by Viking. And it still would have been. But not by Aaron Ginsberg, with whom she made the original deal. A High Court judge might consider that an interesting legal dilemma. And who's going to publish William Warwick, now you're no longer with Viking?
The Ginsberg Press. Anatoly and I will be the company's first authors, and Aaron will also be presenting me with a new fountain pen.
A new pen? It's a long story, which I'll save when you get back from your ball meeting,
said Harry, breaking into the top of his egg.
I'm still a little surprised that Mulberry hadn't considered the possibility of Aaron setting up his own company, and didn't include a clause in the merger document preventing him from poaching any of Viking's authors. I'm sure he did consider it, but if he'd inserted such a clause, Aaron's lawyers would have realized immediately what he was up to. Perhaps he doubted that Aaron would have the resources to set up a new publishing company.
Well, he got that wrong, said Harry. Aaron's already had several offers for his shares in Viking Mulberry, including one from Rex Mulberry himself, who clearly doesn't want any of his rivals to get their hands on Aaron's 34% stake.
What goes around?
Said Emma. Harry smiled as he sprinkled a little salt on his egg.
But however much you like Aaron, continued Emma, after his obvious lack of judgment when it came to Mulberry, are you sure he's the right man to be your American publisher? If you were to sign a 3-book contract and then...
I admit I have my doubts, said Harry. But I've been reassured by the fact that Aaron's father has agreed to return as president of the new company.
Is that a hands-on job?
Harold Ginsberg doesn't do hands-off.
Item number 1. Declared Emma in her crisp, clear chairman's voice. The latest update on the building of our second luxury liner, the MV Balmoral. She glanced towards the group's new chief executive, Eric Hurst, who was looking down at an already open file.
"The board will be pleased to learn," he said, "that despite a few unavoidable hold-ups, which is not unusual in such a major undertaking, we are still well on course to launch the new ship in September. Equally important, we remain within our forecast budget, having anticipated most of the issues that so bedeviled the construction of the Buckingham."
"With one or two notable exceptions," said Admiral Summers.
"You're right, Admiral," said Hurst. "I confess that I didn't foresee the need for a second cocktail bar on the upper deck."
"Passengers are allowed to drink on deck?"
said the Admiral. "I'm afraid so," said Emma, suppressing a grin. "But it does mean extra money in our coffers."
The Admiral didn't attempt to suppress a snort.
"Although I still need to keep a watchful eye on the timing of the launch," continued Hurst, "it shouldn't be too long before we can announce the first booking period for the Balmoral."
"I wonder if we've bitten off more than we can chew," chipped in Peter Maynard.
"I think that's the finance director's department, not mine," said Hurst.
"It most certainly is," said Michael Carrick, coming in on cue. "The company's overall position," he said, looking down at his pocket calculator, which the Admiral had already dismissed as a newfangled machine, "is that our turnover is 3% up on this time last year, and that's despite a substantial loan from Barclays to make sure that we don't miss any payments during the building phase."
"How substantial?" demanded Maynard.
2 million, said Carrick, not needing to check the figure.
"Can we afford to service such a large overdraft?"
"Yes, Mr. Maynard, but only because our cash flow is also up on last year, along with increased bookings on the Buckingham. It seems the current generation of 70-year-olds are refusing to die, and have rather taken to the idea of an annual cruise, so much so that we have recently introduced a loyalty program for customers who've taken a holiday with us on more than 3 occasions.
"And what does membership entitle them to?" asked Maurice Brasher, Barclays' representative on the board.
20% off the price of any voyage as long as it's booked more than a year in advance. It encourages our regulars to look upon the Buckingham as their second home."
"What if they die before the year is up?" asked Maynard.
"They get every penny back," said Emma. "Barrington's is in the luxury liner business, Mr. Maynard. We're not undertakers."
"But can we still make a profit?" pressed Brasher, "if we give so many of our customers a 20% discount?"
"Yes," said Carrick. "There's still a further 10% leeway, and don't forget, once they're on board, they spend money in our shops and bars, as well as the 24-hour casino."
"Something else I don't approve of," muttered the Admiral.
"What's our current occupancy rate?" asked Maynard.
81% over the past 12 months, often 100% on the upper decks, which is why we're building more staterooms on the Balmoral.
"And what's break-even?"
68%, said Carrick.
"Very satisfactory," said Brasher.
"While I agree with you, Mr. Brasher, we can't afford to relax," said Emma. "Union Castle are planning to convert the Reina del Mar into a luxury liner, and Cunard and P&O have both recently begun construction on ships that will carry over 2,000 passengers.
There followed a long silence, while members of the board tried to take this information in.
"Is New York still our most lucrative run?" asked Maynard, who hadn't appeared particularly interested in the other director's questions.
"Yes," said Hurst, "but the Baltic cruise is also proving popular. Southampton to Leningrad, taking in Copenhagen, Oslo, Stockholm and Helsinki."
"But now we're launching a second ship, and considering how many other liners are already on the high seas," continued Maynard, "do you anticipate any staffing problems?"
Emma was puzzled by the number of questions Maynard was asking. She was beginning to suspect him of having his own agenda.
"Well, that shouldn't be a problem," said Captain Turnbull, who hadn't spoken until then. "Barrington's is a popular line to work for, especially with the Filipinos. They remain on board for 11 months, never leaving the ship and rarely spending a thing."
"What about the 12th month?" asked Sebastian.
That's when they go home and hand over their hard-earned cash to their wives and families. Then they report back for duty 28 days later.
Poor blighters, said Brasher.
In truth, Mr. Brasher, said Turnbull, the Filipinos are the happiest members of my crew. They tell me they'd far rather be with the Barrington line than spending 12 months out of work in Manila.
What about the officers? Any problems there, Captain?
At least 6 qualified men apply for every available job, Admiral.
Any women? Asked Emma.
Yes, we now have our first woman on the bridge, said Turnbull. Claire Thompson. She's the first mate and proving damned effective.
What has the world come to? Said the Admiral. Let's hope I don't live to see a woman Prime Minister.
Let's hope you do, said the Chairman, gently chiding her favourite director. Because the world has moved on, and perhaps we should too. Emma looked at her watch. Any other business? The company secretary coughed, a sign that he had something he needed to tell the board.
Mr. Webster, said Emma, sitting back, aware that he was not a man to be hurried.
I feel I should inform the board that Lady Virginia Fenwick has disposed of her 7.5% shareholding in the company.
But I thought,
began Emma, and the shares have been registered at company's house in the name of the new owner.
But I thought,
repeated Emma, looking directly at her son.
It must have been a private transaction, said Sebastian. I can assure you her shares never came up for sale on the open market. If they had, my broker would have picked them up immediately on behalf of Farthings, and Hakeem Bashara would have joined the board as the bank's representative.
Everybody in the room began to speak at once. They were all asking the same question. If Bashara didn't buy the shares, who did? The company secretary waited for the board to settle before he answered their collective cry.
Mr. Desmond Mellor.
There was an immediate uproar, which was silenced only by Sebastian's curt interjection.
I have a feeling Mellor won't be returning as a member of the board. It would be far too obvious, and wouldn't suit his purpose.
Emma looked relieved.
No, I think he'll select someone else to represent him. Someone who's never sat on the board before.
Every eye was now fixed on Sebastian. But it was the Admiral who asked,
And who do you think that might be?
Adrian Sloane.
Chapter 7. A black stretch limousine was parked outside the Sherry Netherland. A smartly dressed chauffeur opened the back door as Harry walked out of the hotel. He climbed in and sank onto the back seat, ignoring the morning papers stacked neatly on the cocktail bar opposite him. Who drank at that time in the morning, Harry wondered. He closed his eyes and tried to concentrate. Harry had told Aaron Ginsberg several times that he didn't need a stretch limo to take him on the short journey from the hotel to the studio. A yellow cab would have been just fine.
It's all part of the service the Today program gives its headline guests.
Harry gave in, although he knew Emma would not have approved.
An extravagant waste of the company's money, as NBC would have discovered if Emma had been its chairman.
Harry recalled the first time he'd appeared on an American breakfast radio show more than 20 years before, when he had been promoting his debut William Warwick novel. It had been a fiasco. His already brief spot was cut short when the previous two guests, Mel Blanc and Clark Gable, both overran their allotted time. And when it was finally his turn in front of the microphone, Harry had forgotten to mention the title of his book, and it quickly became clear that his host, Matt Jacobs, hadn't read it. Harry was determined not to suffer the same fate with Uncle Joe, which the New York Times had already described as the most anticipated book of the season. All three morning shows had offered him their highest-rated spot at 7:24 a.m. 6 minutes didn't sound a long time, but in television terms, only ex-presidents and Oscar winners could take it for granted. As Aaron pointed out,
just think how much we'd have to pay for a 6-minute peak time advertisement.
The limo came to a halt outside the glass-fronted studio on Columbus Avenue. A smartly dressed young woman was standing on the sidewalk waiting for him.
"Good morning, Harry," she said. "My name is Anne, and I'm your special assistant. I'll take you straight through to makeup."
"Thank you," said Harry, who still hadn't got used to people he'd never met calling him by his Christian name.
"As you know, you're on at 7:24 for 6 minutes, and your interviewer will be Matt Jacobs."
Harry groaned. Would he have read the book this time?
"Great," he said.
Harry hated makeup. He'd showered and shaved only an hour before, but it was a ritual he knew he couldn't refuse, despite insisting,
"As little as possible, please."
After a liberal amount of cream was applied to his cheeks and powder dabbed on his forehead and chin, the makeup girl asked,
"Shall I remove those stray gray hairs?"
"Certainly not," said Harry. She looked disappointed and satisfied herself with trimming his eyebrows. Once he'd escaped, Anne escorted him through to the green room, where he sat quietly in a corner while a B-movie star, whose name he didn't catch, was telling an attentive audience what it was like to share a scene with Paul Newman. At 7:20, the door swung open, and Anne reappeared to carry out her most important function of the day.
"Time to take you through to the studio, Harry."
Harry jumped up and followed her down a long corridor. He was far too nervous to speak, which she was clearly accustomed to. She stopped outside a closed door, on which a notice declared, "Do not enter when red light is on." When the light turned green, she heaved open the heavy door and led him into a studio the size of an aircraft hangar, crammed with arc lights and cameras, with technicians and floor staff running in every direction during the ad break. Harry smiled at the studio audience, who, from the blank expressions on their faces, clearly didn't have a clue who he was. He turned his attention to the host, Matt Jacobs, who was seated on a sofa looking like a spider waiting for a passing fly. A studio assistant handed him a copy of Uncle Joe, while a second powdered his nose. Jacobs glanced at the cover before turning to the back flap to check the author's biography. He finally turned to the front flap and read the synopsis of the book. This time, Harry was prepared. While he waited to be taken to his place, he studied his inquisitor carefully. Jacobs didn't seem to have aged in the past 20 years, although Harry suspected the makeup girl had been allowed to use her considerable skills to defy the passage of time. Or had he succumbed to a facelift? The studio manager invited Harry to join Jacobs on the sofa. He was graced with a, "Good morning, Mr. Clifton." But then his host became distracted by a note yet another assistant placed in front of him.
60 seconds to transmission," said a voice from somewhere beyond the arc lights.
"Where will it be?"
asked Jacobs.
"The page will come up on camera too," said the floor manager.
30 seconds.
This was the moment when Harry always wanted to get up and leave the studio. "Uncle Joe, Uncle Joe, Uncle Joe," he repeated under his breath. "Don't forget to keep mentioning the title of the book," Aaron had reminded him, "because it's not your name on the cover."
10 seconds.
Harry took a sip of water as a hand appeared in front of his face, displaying 5 splayed fingers.
5, 4.
Jacobs dropped his notes on the floor.
3, 2.
And looked straight into the camera.
1.
The hand disappeared.
"Welcome back," said Jacobs, reading directly from the teleprompter. "My next guest is the crime novelist Harry Clifton, but today we're not discussing one of his works, but a book he smuggled out of the Soviet Union."
Jacobs held up his copy of Uncle Joe, which filled the whole screen. "Good start," thought Harry.
"But let me make it clear," continued Jacobs, "that it was not the book itself that Mr. Clifton smuggled out, just the words. He says that while he was locked up in a Russian prison cell with Anatoly Babakov, Uncle Joe's author, he learnt the entire manuscript by heart in 4 days. And after he had been released, he wrote it out word for word.
Some people might find this hard to believe, said Jacobs, before turning to face Harry for the first time, and from the incredulous look on his face, he was clearly one of them.
Let me try and understand what you're suggesting, Mr. Clifton. You shared a cell with the distinguished author Anatoly Babakov, a man you'd never met before.
Harry nodded as the camera swung on to him.
During the next 4 days, he recited the entire contents of his banned book, Uncle Joe, an account of the 11 years he worked in the Kremlin as Joseph Stalin's interpreter.
That is correct, said Harry.
So when you were released from prison 4 days later, like a professional actor, you knew your part off by heart.
Harry remained silent, as it was now clear that Jacobs had his own agenda.
I'm sure you'll agree, Mr. Clifton, that no actor, however seasoned, could be expected to remember 48,000 words after only 4 days of rehearsal.
I am not an actor, said Harry.
Forgive me, said Jacobs, not looking as if he wanted to be forgiven. But I suspect that you are a very accomplished actor who has invented this whole story for no other purpose than to promote your latest book. If that's not the case, perhaps you'll allow me to put your claim to the test.
Without waiting for Harry to respond, Jacobs turned to another camera and, holding up the book, said,
If your story is to be believed, Mr. Clifton, you shouldn't have any difficulty in reciting whichever page I select from Mr. Babakov's book.
Harry frowned as Jacobs added,
I'm going to turn to a page at random, which will appear on the screen so that all our viewers can see it. You will be the one person who won't be able to.
Harry's heart reached a thumping pace, because he hadn't read Uncle Joe's since he'd handed in the manuscript to Aaron Ginsberg some time ago.
But first, said Jacobs, turning back to face his guest, let me ask you to confirm that we have never met before.
Just once, Harry replied.
You interviewed me on your radio program 20 years ago, but you've clearly forgotten.
Jacobs looked flustered, but quickly recovered.
Then let's hope your memory is better than mine, he said, not making any attempt to hide his sarcasm.
He picked up the book and flicked through several pages before stopping at random.
I'm going to read out the first line of page 127, he continued, and then we'll see if you can complete the rest of the page.
Harry began to concentrate.
One of the many subjects no one ever dared to raise with Stalin.
Harry tried to gather his thoughts, and as the seconds passed, the audience began murmuring among themselves, while Jacob's smile became broader. He was just about to speak again when Harry said,
One of the many subjects no one ever dared to raise with Stalin was the role he played during the siege of Moscow, when the outcome of the Second World War still hung in the balance. Did he, like most of the government ministers and their officials, beat a hasty retreat to Kyubyshev on the Volga? Or did he, as he claimed, refuse to leave the capital and remain in the Kremlin, personally organizing the defense of the city? His version became legend, part of the official Soviet history, although several people saw him on the platform moments before the train departed for Kyubyshev. And there are no reliable reports of anyone seeing him in Moscow again until the Russian army had driven the enemy from the gates of the city. Few of those who expressed any doubts about Stalin's version lived to tell the tale.
Harry looked into the camera and continued to deliver the next 22 lines without hesitation. He knew he'd come to the end of the page when the studio audience burst into applause. Jacobs took a little longer to recover his composure, but eventually managed,
I might even read this book myself,
with an ingratiating smile.
That would make a change, said Harry,
immediately regretting his words, although some of the studio audience laughed and applauded even louder, while others just gasped. Jacobs turned to face the camera.
We'll take a short break and return after these messages.
But when the green light came on, Jacobs yanked off his lapel mic, jumped up from the sofa, and marched across to the floor manager.
Get him off the set now.
But he's got another 3 minutes, said the floor manager, checking his clipboard.
I don't give a fuck. Wheel on the next guest.
Do you really want to interview Troy Donahue for 6 minutes?
Anyone but that guy, he said,
gesturing in Harry's direction before beckoning Anne.
Get him off the set now, he repeated.
Anne hurried across to the sofa.
Will you please come with me, Mr. Clifton? She said,
not sounding as if it was a request. She led Harry out of the studio and didn't stop until they were back on the sidewalk, where she abandoned her headline guest, although there was no sign of a chauffeur waiting by an open limo door. Harry hailed a cab, and on the way back to the Sherry Netherland, he checked page 127 of his copy of Uncle Joe. Had he left out the word hasty? He couldn't be sure. He went straight up to his room, removed his makeup, and took his second shower of the morning. He didn't know if it was the huge arc lights or Jacob's hectoring manner that had caused him to sweat so profusely. But once he put on a clean shirt and his other suit, Harry took the lift to the mezzanine floor. When he walked into the dining room, he was surprised how many people gave him a second look. He ordered breakfast, but didn't open the New York Times, as he thought about how angry the Ginsbergs would be after he'd humiliated one of Breakfast TV's leading presenters. He was due to meet them in Aaron's office at 9 to discuss the details of his national tour, but Harry assumed he'd now be heading back to Heathrow on the next available flight. Harry signed the check and decided to walk to Aaron's new office on Lexington Avenue. He left the Sherry Netherlands just after 8:40, and by the time he reached Lexington, he was just about ready to face the headmaster's wrath. He took the elevator to the third floor, and when the doors opened, Kirsty was standing there. She said only, "Good morning, Mr. Clifton," before leading him through to the chairman's office. She knocked and opened the door to reveal a carbon copy of the office Harry had such fond memories of. Hemingway, Fitzgerald, Green, and Buchan all stared down at him from the oak-paneled walls. Harry stepped inside to see father and son seated opposite each other at the partner's desk. The moment they saw him, they stood and applauded.
"Hail the conquering hero," said Aaron.
"But I thought you'd be
ecstatic," said Harold Ginsberg, slapping him on the back. "The phone's been ringing off the hook for the past hour, and you're said to be on every major talk show across the country. But be warned, everyone's going to pick a different page after your triumph this morning."
"But what about Jacobs?"
"He's turned you into an overnight star. You may never be invited back onto his show, but all the other networks are chasing you."
Harry spent the next 7 days flying from airport to airport. Boston, Washington, Dallas, Chicago, San Francisco, and Los Angeles. He was rushed from studio to studio in an attempt to fulfill every commitment on his revised schedule. Whenever he was in the air, in the back of a limousine, or in a green room, even in bed, he read and reread Uncle Joe, astounding audiences right across the country with his prodigious memory. By the time he touched down in Los Angeles to be Johnny Carson's headline guest on The Tonight Show, journalists and television crews were turning up at the airports, hoping to grab an interview with him even on the move. Exhausted, Harry finally returned on the red-eye to New York, only to be whisked off in yet another limo to his publisher's office on Lexington Avenue. When Kirsty opened the door of the chairman's office, Harold and Aaron Ginsberg were holding up a copy of the New York Times bestseller list. Harry leapt in the air when he saw that Uncle Joe had hit the top spot.
"How I wish Anatoly could share this moment."
"You're looking at the wrong list," said Aaron.
Harry looked across to the other side of the page to see that William Warwick and the Smoking Gun headed the fiction list.
"This is a first even for me,"
said Harold, as he opened a bottle of champagne.
"Number one in fiction and non-fiction on the same day."
Harry turned to see Aaron placing a framed photograph of Harry Clifton on the wall between John Buchan and Graham Greene. Giles Barrington, 1971. Chapter 8.
"I'm afraid that won't be possible," said Giles.
"Why not?" demanded Griff. "Most people won't even remember what happened in Berlin, and let's face it, you wouldn't be the only member of Parliament who's been divorced."
"Twice, and both times for adultery," said Giles.
This silenced his parliamentary agent for a moment.
"And I'm afraid there's another problem I haven't told you about."
"Go on, surprise me,"
said Griff with an exaggerated sigh.
"I've been trying to get in touch with Karen Pengelly."
"You've been what?"
"In fact, I'm on my way to Cornwall to find out if her father can help."
"Are you out of your tiny mind?"
"Quite possibly," admitted Giles.
The Labour agent for Bristol Docklands covered his face with his hands.
"It was a one-night stand, Giles, or have you forgotten?"
"That's the problem. I haven't forgotten. And there's only one way to find out if it was more than that for her."
"Is this the same man who won an MC escaping from the Germans, then built a formidable reputation as a cabinet minister, and when he's thrown a lifeline which would allow him to return to the House of Commons, rejects it?"
"I know it doesn't make any sense," said Giles. "But if it was just a one-night stand, I have to tell you I've never spent a night like it."
"For which she was undoubtedly well rewarded."
"So what will you do now I've made my decision?"
Giles said, ignoring the comment.
"If you're really not going to fight the seat, I'll have to appoint a subcommittee to select a new candidate.
You'll have a flood of applications, and while inflation is at 10% and the Tories' only solution is a three-day week, a poodle wearing a red rosette would be elected.
Which is precisely why you shouldn't just throw in the towel."
"Haven't you been listening to a word I've said?"
"Every word. But if you really have made up your mind, I hope you'll be available to advise whoever we select as candidate."
"But what can I possibly tell them that you can't, Griff? Let's face it, you were organizing elections when I was still in short trousers."
"But not as the candidate. That's a unique experience. So will you accompany him?"
"Or her,"
said Giles, smiling.
"Or even her," said Griff, "when they're out walking the streets and canvassing the estates."
"If you think it will help, I'll make myself available whenever you want me."
"It could make the difference between just winning and securing a large enough majority to make it tough for the Tories to overturn at the next election."
"My God, the Labour Party's lucky to have you," said Giles. "I'll do everything I can to help."
"Thank you," said Griff. "I apologize for my earlier outbursts. Truth is, I've always been a cynic. Goes with the territory, I suppose. So let's hope I'm wrong this time. Mind you, I've never gone much on fairy tales. So if you do change your mind about standing, I can hold off appointing a selection committee for at least a couple of weeks."
"Won't you ever give up?"
"Not while there's the slightest chance of you being the candidate."
As Giles sat alone in the first-class carriage on the way to Truro, he thought carefully about what Griff had said. Was he sacrificing his whole political career for a woman who might not even have given him a second thought since Berlin? Had he allowed his imagination to override his common sense? And if he did meet Karen again, would the bubble burst? There was also the possibility, the strong possibility which he tried to push to the back of his mind, that Karen had been no more than a Stasi plant, simply doing her job, proving that his veteran agent was not a cynic, but simply a realist. By the time the Penzance flyer pulled into Truro Station just after 6, Giles was none the wiser. He took a taxi to the Mason's Arms, where he had agreed to meet John Pengelly later that evening. Once he had signed the register, he climbed the stairs to his room and unpacked his overnight bag. He had a bath, changed his clothes, and went down to the bar a few minutes before 7, as he didn't want to keep Karen's father waiting. As Giles walked into the bar, he spotted a man seated at a corner table, at whom he wouldn't have taken a second look had he not immediately stood and waved. Giles strode across to join him and shook his outstretched hand. No introduction was necessary.
"Let me get you a drink, Sir Giles," said John Pengelly with an unmistakable West Country burr. "Local bitter's not half bad, or you might prefer a whiskey."
"A half of bitter will be just fine," said Giles, taking a seat at the small beer-stained table. While Karen's father was ordering the drinks, Giles took a closer look at him. He must have been around 50, perhaps 55, although his hair had already turned grey. His Harris tweed jacket was well worn, but still fitted perfectly, suggesting he hadn't put on more than a few pounds since his army days, and probably exercised regularly. Although he appeared reserved, even diffident, he clearly wasn't a stranger to these parts, because one of the locals seated at the bar hailed him as if he were a long-lost brother. How cruel that he had to live alone, thought Giles, with his wife and daughter unable to join him, for no other reason than that they were on the wrong side of a wall. Pengelly returned a few moments later, carrying 2 half-pints, one of which he placed on the table in front of Giles.
"It was kind of you to make such a long journey, sir. I only hope you'll feel it's been worthwhile."
"Please call me Giles, as I hope we'll not only be friends, but that we'll be able to help each other's causes."
"When you're an old soldier..."
"Not so old," said Giles, taking a sip of his beer.
"Don't forget we both served in the last war," he added,
trying to put him at ease.
"But tell me, how did you first meet your wife?" "It was after the war, when I was stationed with the British forces in Berlin. I was a corporal in the supply depot where Greta was a stacker. The only work she could get. It must have been love at first sight, because she couldn't speak a word of English and I couldn't speak any German."
Giles smiled.
"Bright, though. She picked up my language much quicker than I got the hang of hers. Of course, I knew from the start that it wasn't going to be plain sailing. Not least because my mates thought any kraut skirt was only good for one thing. But Greta wasn't like that. By the time my tour of duty came to an end, I knew I wanted to marry her, whatever the consequences. That's when my problems began. A leg over behind the Naffy canteen was one thing, but wanting to marry one of them was considered nothing less than fraternization, when neither side would trust you. When I told the orderly officer that I intended to marry Greta, even if it meant I had to stay in Berlin, they put every possible obstacle in my path. Within days, I was handed my DMOB papers and told I would be shipped out within a week. I became desperate, even considered deserting, which would have meant years in the glasshouse if they caught me. And then a barrack room lawyer informed me they couldn't stop me marrying Greta as she was pregnant. So that's what I told them."
"Then what happened?" asked Giles.
"All hell broke loose. My discharge papers arrived a few days later. Greta lost her job, and I couldn't find any work. It didn't help that a few weeks later she really was pregnant, with Karen."
"I want to hear all about Karen, but not before I've ordered another round." Giles picked up the 2 empty glasses and made his way over to the bar. "Same again, please, but make them pints this time." Pengelly took a long draught before he continued with his story.
"Karen made all the sacrifices bearable, even the suspicion and ridicule we'd both had to endure. If I adored Greta, I worshipped Karen. Must have been about a year later that my old duty officer at the depot asked me to fill in for someone who was on sick leave. Time is a great healer. And I was invited to act as a civilian liaison officer between the British and German workers, because by then, thanks to Greta, my German was pretty fluent.
The British have many fine qualities, but they're lazy when it comes to learning someone else's language. So I quickly made myself indispensable. The pay wasn't great, but I spent every spare penny on Karen and every spare moment with her. And like all women, she knew I was a sucker for a cuddle. It may be a cliché, but she had me wound round her little finger.
Me too, thought Giles, taking another sip of his beer.
To my delight, said Pengelly, the English school in Berlin allowed Karen to sit the entrance exam, and a few weeks later she was offered a place. Everyone assumed she was English. I even had my Cornish accent, as you may have noticed. So from then on, I never had to worry about her education. In fact, when she reached sixth form, there was even talk of her going to Oxford, but that was before the wall went up. Once that monstrosity had been erected, Karen had to settle for a place at the East German School of Languages, which frankly is nothing more than a Stasi recruitment center. The only surprise came when she chose to study Russian as her first